The following is an at-will presentation.
Welcome to The Marrow, conversations with creatives about who they are and why they make what they make. I'm your host, Josh Reebok. Today I'm speaking with photographer Ben Fink Shapiro. Ben Fink Shapiro, a remarkable photographer. Your work has appeared in American, British, and Korean Vogue, Bal Harbour Magazine, Quest, amongst many others. Your work spans from fashion to art to portraiture. Thank you so, so much for taking time out of your very, very rainy Manhattan day to stop by The Marrow.
Well, thank you, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here.
Of course. And I said this to you, obviously, before, you know, we came on the air, but I do want to say it again that my afternoon leading up to our recording session here was completely compromised by just looking at your work. And man, I'm just gonna start with a little rant about it before I dive in with you. But I love the fact that it really is so hard to just label it as this is what you do, because there's just so much to it and there's so much variety. I mean, I saw in your portfolio, and I would encourage everybody listening, if you can, while I'm talking with Ben, if you have the ability to go to benfinkshapiro.com while we're talking and see some of this stuff, I think you'll really, really enjoy it. But you have these kind of dreamy photographs that feel kind of like illusory. Like there's one in particular where there's this woman. And she almost looks like she's from...
I'm already loving this description.
Okay, good. Well, please tell me if I botch it.
No, not at all. I hate talking about my own work like this, so I love hearing it.
This woman who almost looks like a China doll brought to life, almost looks like she's from another time, and she is pushing this, like, wicker baby carriage. and it's remarkable. And so there's this kind of dreamy, illusory image. And then you have others like that where it's like waves crashing on the shore, but the way you capture it in your photography, I mean, it looks like 10 million sapphires just kind of drooling onto the sand. So you have like that end, and then you have this very innocent, playful eye. Like you have an image of, I think his name is Mark Mullet, and he's diving,
hey,
he's jumping fully clothed into a swimming pool, and he's got one of those like foam.
Is he holding a noodle or something?
Yeah, like around his neck. Yeah. So you have those, but then, and listeners of The Marrow know that this is the way I tend to gravitate most, then you have these really kind of haunting photos where it seems like beneath the surface of your subject, there's like this kind of flammable wrath that could just be ignited at any moment. I mean, I see those in your images of Tia Woods and Hannah Ferguson and Lori Newhouse. I mean, Ben, I mean it, man. It is such a privilege. Forgive my opening.
No, this is amazing. that's an incredible description. That's awesome, Josh.
It's true. It really is true. But so I want to start, and then I will try my best to shut my mouth for a moment. But my first question to you is, given your work, in your opinion and in your eyes, what makes a good photograph?
It's a good question. For me, things visually, I'm a very aesthetic guy. So I need to, you know, whether it's a photograph or an interior of a room, for me to appreciate it and for me to like put my name on it or whatever, I need to just think it is aesthetically pleasing. So as far as what makes a good photograph, generally in my portraiture, the goal is to make people look good. There's definitely a little bit of the Richard Avedon American West type thing of showing the real humanity in, you know, sort of inside of a person. But generally when people are being photographed by me, they want to look good. And the goal is basically to be, this is the most attractive picture this person's ever had taken of them. And that means something totally different to everybody, because everyone has their own look, and no matter what you look like, you know, you can look good.
Yeah, sure.
And then if it's a portrait, you know, I like to tell something about the person. So whether it's based off their environment or their slight expression, I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No, you are.
I do a better job talking about my work just like showing it. So
sure,
talking
sure.
about
no,
it
you
is,
are.
is, I mean...
Well, part of what, I mean, I hear you saying, even based on, like, trying to encapsulate the human being so they're not just a type or they're not just kind of this caricature, but they're a real human being. I mean, part of, you know, I know nothing about photography except for that I know when something resonates with me.
Sure, that's
what I do know that, I think. And there's a photographer named David Allen Harvey who he's really most well known for his street work, born in San Francisco and now does most of his work on the East Coast. But he talks about how when shooting, don't shoot how it looks, shoot how it feels. And I see that in your work. I mean, even as you talk about, you know, kind of accentuating what might make someone attractive in their eyes, not necessarily in the eyes of the general public, but in their eyes.
Right.
It's like oftentimes I see in your work you capturing maybe how they feel or an emotion or a moment in their life maybe beneath the surface that's unique to that person.
Well, I'm going to have you write my next show opening or my book forward. This is phenomenal.
Well, So, but this didn't all happen. I mean, not only your success, but also the refinement of your craft. So,
sure.
I mean, do you remember the first photograph you ever took?
Yeah, I remember the first roll of film I ever took. It was analog. I was shooting, you know, with film.
Okay.
So I had a darkroom in my basement growing up.
How old were you?
So I was 15. And it was always a hobby of my dad. So we always had darkrooms in our house. I was 15. I took a photography course in 10th grade, and just I immediately fell in love with it. And my first roll of film, I probably spent like 20 minutes like composing every shot, whether it was the aperture and the shutter speed. And I would stare at whatever I was shooting.
Yeah.
And I remember my dad being next to me during this first roll. He would be like, "Okay, like, you can click the shutter." I'm like, "No, I haven't like composed it yet." He was like, "Oh my god, this is so painful." And you know, at that point, you weren't shooting digitally, so, you know, every frame really mattered. And the first roll of film, one of my pictures, I entered it into a competition that got accepted to be displayed at the Cincinnati Art Museum.
Really?
In my first roll, I was like, wow. I was like, huh.
I mean, what was your reaction? Was that your goal when you set out to shoot this role?
No. I mean, so... Growing up, like, visual stuff was always my strengths.
Okay.
So, you know, I was 5, I wanted to be a painter, but then I turned out to be a terrible painter. so it was always, you know, always using my eyes. That was always the stuff that I was the best at, generally. And now and then, 15, I took the photography course not thinking I was doing anything professionally. And I was really good at it. And being an insecure 15-year-old, with not a lot of self-confidence, finding something that you're good at, you kind of latch onto
that's
that.
That's massive.
Yeah, I mean that really was everything. I'm like, oh my god, like.
Were you an insecure 15-year-old?
Yeah, I was I had a little depression in eighth and ninth grade. Yeah, and then 15, I started taking pictures, and like my whole life changed.
Yeah, wow.
It's so, you know, you're just trying to like find yourself. That's really the beginning. And then I really took it and ran. I mean, I submitted this picture to that contest, and I felt that I was good. I was also supposedly the worst student in the class. The teacher would hold up my photos on, like, how not to crop things. And like
In front of everyone?
Yeah. He would be like, this is Ben's. Like, do not do this.
Ben.
This is, but, and to me, I was like, at that point, I already had confidence in my photography. I'm like, okay, well, like thanks.
Yeah.
Like, The academic institutions in photography never really gave me the thumbs up, which, you know, I think is sort of saying a lot, actually.
Yeah, so. Right. But, and yet, you obviously didn't let that
cloud
your confidence or completely suffocate your desire to pursue this. And I want to come back to that in a second, but you mentioned, and it sounds as if your dad played a pretty pivotal role.
He did.
In introducing you to photography. But I'd love to hear more about him and just your whole family. I mean, you grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yep.
I mean, what was childhood like for you?
Childhood was awesome. And this is easy coming from a week home for Thanksgiving this past week. A lot of memories coming back. Childhood, I'm a middle child. Older brother, younger sister.
Okay.
Very loving, supporting parents. And they both worked. My mom's an attorney. Works, represents poor working with poor people for the Legal Aid Society. And my dad's a pediatrician, and he works mostly in child abuse. So both my parents work with kids professionally. And for those that need it. So it was a very loving, supportive, nurturing environment. And we weren't pushed to do anything professionally. We weren't pushed to be a doctor or a lawyer, and none of my siblings are either. We were always, like, we didn't have Nintendo. We didn't have cable TV. We were supposed to do, like, arts and crafts. Like, you know,
That was, like, in the family soil.
We didn't have, you know, Nintendo. We had an amazing closet full of art projects. And so we get home from school and, like, you might take out some toothpicks and some super glue. Like, that's seriously. And at the time, you want to go to your friend's house and, like, play Sega or something.
Sure.
But, so yeah, I mean, that's, so we definitely grew up in a very nurturing environment.
Well, and that's so interesting to me, because so many, it's not uncommon for guests on the Marrow to say that they grew up in nurturing environments. But I wouldn't say that it's consistent that those guests say they grew up in an environment where the arts were fostered the way you're talking about. Not that they were necessarily despised or disparaged, but not where they were pushed as a viable life pursuit or as a wonderful way to spend your weekend.
They definitely didn't suggest it as a life pursuit, but they didn't tell me not to. Yeah. Since they both have professional degrees. It was, I think, a little scary at times when, like, this was really, when it was obvious this was really the path I was going to take, because they couldn't, you know, help send me to graduate school. You know, they couldn't send me on some path.
Yeah. Was there a moment when you either sat down with your mom and dad, or where they just knew that this is kind of what you were going to do vocationally for the remainder of your life?
I would say it was a slow progression of just probably them realizing and being, you know, happy with it. But it's been a struggle. I mean, you know, I'm 31. It's, you know, being a freelance photographer when you graduate college, you know, it's not like a walk in the park. You know, you gotta hustle.
Well, and so that brings us to an interesting era of not only the refinement of your craft, but also your career. And I would imagine also just personally. But so you graduate from Vassar. And you start
barely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you start assisting two really remarkable photographers, Miles Aldridge and Kenneth Willard. What was talk about their work, talk about what you admire about them, and talk about what you learned in that experience under their kind of tutelage.
Interesting. So that was during the first year after graduation. I tried to get an agent, a well-known agent in the city. He was like, "Your work's great," and this one, I was 22. But you never worked for anybody. People are going to want to know that you work for someone else just so if they think you're good, they're like, oh, yeah, you know, this is why. Because, you know, he's had the experience under X.
Yeah, sure.
So working under both those two guys, one of the main things I learned, Josh, was just about the business, how a photo shoot is, you know, like how it's run. How many, if there's 40 people on set, what is everyone doing? And what are the different roles? And so when you're in this business, you're an artist, but you're also a business person, and you've got to do both successfully if you're going to make it. So actually learning a lot about that was really important. They both shoot very differently than I do, which is totally cool.
Yeah.
Miles generally shoots on a tripod, and he's a very detail-oriented photographer where everything's in his perfect place and kind of sets a shot up.
And his work is so colorful.
Super colorful, vibrant. Yeah.
It's like psychedelic.
Completely.
I mean, it's like if you – I'm a fan of do you know the film director Nicholas Winding Refn? And I think he's a Danish director. But he did Drive, Only God Forgives, Neon Demon, and Bronson, amongst others. But Miles Aldridge's photography reminds me of that, where there's this just kind of electricity in the color palette all the time. A lot of color contrast, but it really just like it really pops.
I mean, we're using gels, and he's that's a very good description. He should hire you also to write his forward.
So is that what drew you to him?
He was one of my favorite photographers at the time, and I was at Milk Studios one day, and I met someone that worked for him, and they're like, "We can get you on a set." I was like, "This is that would be awesome."
Yeah.
And then Kenneth, he shoots a bunch of, you know, beauty stuff, Maybelline, MAC Cosmetics, and Both of them are definitely hyper professionals in the way that they're not shooting ad hoc. It's everything is, you know, done for, like, everything is lit for a very specific reason. And right. you know, photography is all about light. People say you know, photography is painting with light. That really is what photography is. So I think you can have a good eye, whether you're a painter, a photographer, interior decorator, or whatever. And then the way to be good at photography is, besides that and being a people person, yeah. which I think is extremely important to what I do, you got to know how to light. And so, you know,
yeah.
and someone looks good or bad depending yeah. on where the light is.
And you feel like you've developed a lot in that specific regard under Miles and Kenneth?
There's just having that experience and seeing yeah. how they light stuff, yeah.
How do you feel about I can't take a picture.
Okay.
And
meaning you can't be photographed or you can't
both.
Physically take a picture?
Well, put it this way. I can be photographed, but typically, like, if I'm at the birthday party and they're taking like 7 pictures, the first 6 are going to be deleted until I don't look awkward, and okay. the 7th one, then we're going to keep it.
That's pretty funny.
But given like the amount of energy and years you put into refining your craft, and even to hear the way you talk about it, how do you feel about just the omnipresent, I don't know, the omnipresence of cameras in our world, Instagram, cell phones. I mean, how do you feel about that in regards to what you do?
It's a good question. I think about this often, and my opinion on the matter goes back and forth, actually, depending on, I don't know what, but on one end, everyone is a photographer now. Mm-hmm. Every single person probably takes at least one photo a day.
Yeah.
If not many more, depending mm-hmm. on your age.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the younger people even take more. So we go back 50 years, even 10 years, most people weren't taking any pictures every day, not even let alone every week or every month.
Right.
So on one hand, the fact that now everyone is a photographer and everyone has an Instagram, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a good photographer, I think on some levels, it's that much more impressive, possibly. Mm. If you're a good photographer, because now yeah. everyone knows possibly how hard it is to take a picture or how easy it is, depending on if you're a good photographer.
Sure.
It's also made for a lot more competition because it's easier to take a picture now because, you know, you can take 1,000 pictures. And so it's this weird dichotomy of it's as a professional photographer, I think you stand out more when you're a professional photographer now, since everyone's doing it. You're like, oh, how'd you get that shot? I also was standing right there.
Yeah, right.
Mine doesn't look like that.
Right.
And you're like, oh, you know, see, like,
yeah,
you know,
right.
our career is not going to be, you know, forgotten.
Yeah, right.
But then on, you know, some levels, it's, you know, that everyone's a photographer. It's like kind of a funny thing because it's not a physical thing that I can offer someone that someone can't, because like everyone just takes pictures.
Absolutely.
It's just crazy.
Well, and one thing I wonder,
does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I don't have I have very few answers
yeah.
to anything. But I do wonder how the expediency with which we can move through photographs changes the way we approach photography in general. Because I even think about when I'm looking at a photograph on my phone, say it's Instagram or Twitter or, you know, Google Images, I kind of look at it for a second and I just flip. And I don't think that's necessarily all bad, and there's like a good in that. But at the same time, I also wonder how I'm training my brain to interact with art and not just with photography,
yeah.
But with movies or with literature
sure.
or with the ballet. I mean, I think about maybe – I don't know if this is the same or not, but I think about like you know, in my Netflix queue – I can go, well, I'll just start this movie, and if I don't like it after 10 minutes, I can just kind of hit the
yep.
pull the ripcord and bail out. And so I do wonder how that impacts us as people in terms of the way we approach works of art, in particular photography. But I want to – you started to talk about something that we probably haven't addressed enough on this show, and you started to talk about – and this isn't the word you use, but the tension – between artistry and commerce
mm-hmm.
and needing to kind of have a foot in both worlds
yeah.
if you want to do this, you know, and pursue this craft as your vocation and not
for sure.
just in addition to another job.
Right.
How do you navigate that, and what are some of the most important lessons you've learned along the way?
Right. What I was saying earlier about, you know, you have to be a business person and
yeah.
a photographer and an artist. So I mean, when you're working for, say, a fashion brand, and they may hopefully have a very good idea of what they want if there's a good art director behind it or whatever. You know, at the end of the day, you've got a paying client that's hiring you for your artistic craft, but you're creating an advertisement. So once you've been doing it for a while, you get used to it, but you have to, you know, I mean, you have to know when to do what they want to make them happy, and then also know when to veer off from what they want if you're confident your idea is going to be better in the end. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. If you do what they ask and it's not good, it's shit. And they're like, why the fuck did you give me this? And you're like, well, you asked me this. And so you learn at it. I learned a long time ago that if I just give them what they asked for, I'm at risk of not giving them actually what they want, even though they don't know they want it.
That's right.
And so you walk a fine line on set of sort of, you know, sort of playing that game of, when I have an idea or something of doing that wasn't maybe what they wanted, but if I'm quite confident it's going to be good, I've got to lean on that experience to know at least I gave them my best, you know, my best effort to give them what I think they want.
Did you? Absolutely. I mean, can you think of a particular moment when you kind of circumvented what they had said they wanted and given them something different, and they ended up going, wow, this is great?
Oh boy, I need to like go through my portfolio to quickly to remind me of something.
Well, will you think about that, because I'll just keep talking, because part of what I hear you saying, Ben, and I think it's I you know, want in my own industry to continue to learn this. But so much of that, it sounds like, is establishing trust in your collaborations.
Totally.
And even a sense of it's like this, it is this weird kind of artistic waltz where when it's not just in a hermetic lifestyle where we're making things out in the woods that no one else has a say in or a voice in, there has to be this sense of trust in the people we're working with and their opinion. Like, take in my industry with my editor or my agent or my publisher. On the one hand, I have to trust their opinion.
For sure.
But on the other hand, I have to trust mine.
Right.
And so I've had multiple conversations with my agent before where he said, I think you need to take it this direction. And, you know, there have been times where I've had to absorb what at first maybe hurts, or what feels like it kind of, I don't know, damages either my creative ego or even just my esteem, and absorb that and then step back and not allow it to be about me, but allow it to be about the work, and say, is he right about the work? And sometimes he is. And then I always want to honor the work above all, right?
Yeah.
Not me or not even him. But then other times I've had to tell him, look, I trust you to the moon and back, but I trust myself to Pluto and back.
That's a good line. I like that line.
You know, but
the person knows Pluto is farther than
the moon. Yeah, and even I'm thinking in my head, what's that like little acronym for memory? I don't even know if that's right. But that's a weird and for me at times really, really tricky you know, landmine field to navigate is, how do I trust the people I'm collaborating with, but at the same time, trust me?
The same thing. I mean, I rely, and every commercial and fashion photographer does, I rely on my lighting assistants on set very much to light the shot in the way that I'm describing I want this shoot to look and feel. Because generally I'm not setting up the actual lights. I'm saying, you know, I want it to look sunny, but we're shooting inside, and we're going to have a little bit of a blue hue.
Yep.
And then one of the guys that I work with, he will work on creating that atmosphere. And I also very much rely on them. And it's, it's the exact same,
How do you feel like the day of, or as you're approaching a shoot? I mean, it's a couple hours before, maybe a day before. Like, what tends to be going on in you psychologically and emotionally?
I probably have to go to the bathroom a couple times.
You get nervous.
Yeah. Doesn't matter. And I felt a lot better watching ESPN yesterday when they're talking about Tiger Woods making a comeback. and him playing, I think, this following weekend in his first tournament in ages. Mm-hmm. And he said, if I don't get really nervous prior to this tournament, I know something's wrong with me because I always get really nervous.
Yeah.
And the same thing for me.
Yeah.
I have butterflies when I get to the set. And then for like 2 hours of like prep, I also have a sensitive stomach. Sorry, listeners.
Yeah.
So it's a big production. There's so much to go right and there's so much to go wrong.
Yeah.
Whether it's the model showing up, the you liking what the hairstylist is doing, the makeup artist is, producers, art directors. There's so many working parts.
Yeah, right.
And the photographer is the director of it all. You're at the end of the day. I've got to, you know, sign off on every aspect of that. Yeah. And, yeah. It's exciting and nerve-wracking and then until I take the first shot. Once I have the camera, probably at like 11 a.m., because you start at like 7 or 8, you got hours of prep. And then once you actually start shooting, that's gone. But up until that, it's just like, okay, is everything going to like go right this morning? You know, is the wardrobe going to show up? You know,
absolutely.
There's just so many things.
Well, and there's so many things that are obviously beyond your control.
Right.
I mean, what's the, you know, the in addiction language? You know, there's something called the Serenity Prayer.
Okay.
You know, that you pray to your higher power or whatever, and you say, you know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I mean, I would think that the mentality is essential when you step into something like that to go, may my nerves not distract me from the things I can control and lead me to try to keep my hands on the things that I can't. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, Ben, I'm typically on a stage in front of people storytelling and reading poetry, you know, maybe 50 times a year, something like that.
Cool.
And I feel genuine dread, anxiety. I get these kind of coughing fits, and at times they've been so violent that I've actually
I feel like we both need a hug right now.
Yeah, seriously, that I've had to like vomit, behind stage or in a bathroom or something. The first time I remember being on a stage, I was in this like community Christmas pageant.
Okay.
And I was supposed to say, like, the opening line or whatever. And I got up, and the line was, I'm not very tall, but I welcome you all. I'm, like, you know, 6 years old. You know, I have, like, my bowl cut and bow tie or whatever. And I got up there, and I forgot. And I forgot the line.
That's a tough line.
And so, yeah, it's really all seven words. I mean, that can be really tricky. But so I remember my dad came up on stage and he got down on his knees.
No way.
And he ended up saying the line for me.
That's amazing. And so, well done, Dad.
But then like the next time I remember being on stage was years later in my adolescence in some like school play, and I forgot the words then too. Except then
this is when you realized you weren't gonna be an actor.
Yeah, this is when I was like, maybe this is just not in the cards. But there's always for me this sense of like real fear. But to your point, I think I'm learning that there's a way for me to engage that anxiety and allow it to fuel me, to kind of access emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I don't feel anything, it probably just means I'm not present in the moment.
Sure.
Because there is something terrifying. I mean, it's like, holy smokes, like you got to corral 50 people doing a million things to try and capture something in what, one millionth of a second in time. For me, you know, in my own way, but there's something like nerve-wracking about that.
I think I just realized for the first time why it's then really relaxing once I start shooting, because once I'm shooting, I'm in my little camera world. I've got the camera in front of my face. I'm looking at whoever I'm shooting through this lens, and we're just interacting.
Yeah.
And people are doing things on the scene, you know, like on set, and I may not even notice while I'm actually taking the picture.
Yeah.
And you're just in your own little world once you start shooting, and then you put the camera down, and then you're back to directing everything. But it's when you start to connect with your subject like that, it's, you know, the massive set or whatever is, you know, certain now have just become a little, you know, working, you know, funny relationship.
Yeah.
You know, it could be flirty, whatever, between you and whoever you're shooting. I felt, Josh, what you were just describing before when you were 6 years old, I officiated my little sister's wedding this summer.
Wow.
And I was in tears 10, 15 minutes before the ceremony started. I've never done it before.
Yeah.
And I didn't think I was going to get through it.
Really?
I was trying to practice what I was going to say and behind the like barn, and I was like, oh my God, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. But then I got up there and I killed it, I will say that. I couldn't believe it. Like, I mean, 2 minutes in, I was like, okay, I didn't stutter. I didn't, like, lose a piece of paper. I didn't, drip sweat on the paper where I can't even see it anymore.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, oh, hey, I'm doing a good job.
But
I looked at my sister, and she gave me, like, a nod of approval.
the sisterly seal of approval.
Yep.
But there's something to that, though, that it's like, I don't know, like, anxiety indicates that we care. Anxiety can at least indicate that we're invested in what we're doing, that the outcome matters to us, that we actually have a little, I don't know, metaphorically speaking, like we have a little bit of skin in the game.
Sure.
But this is a fascinating component of what you do. Because when I show up to work on a daily basis, not for the marrow, but when I'm writing, I don't have to coax anything out of anybody other than myself.
Mm-hmm.
For you...
You almost did coax me out of my pants like half an hour ago.
But that's not
I guess that was my idea, actually.
But that's not at all true
for
you, because you have to create a space where your subject, a model, feels like they can be as present as you want to be. So how do you go about doing that with another person?
So fortunately for me, and I think that's why I'm able to have the little success that I do have, is I'm naturally a people person, and people generally feel comfortable with me, fortunately. And so I am able to just be myself, and subjects and, models, celebrities, whomever, people respond to that and they feel comfortable. I definitely believe if you're getting your photo taken, if you feel uncomfortable, if the photographer is making you awkward, making you feel awkward, you're going to get a terrible picture.
Hmm.
So, you may, if you're shooting a celebrity, you might have 15 minutes with them, one-on-one time. In the first minute, I've got to become their best friend for those 15 minutes. And I'm able to do that. I mean, kind of like you. I mean, you're asking questions and I'm able to connect with whomever I'm shooting, no matter what their background is or where they're from or what they do or how old they are. I'm always able to find some common ground in some capacity, which I'll give credit to my parents for making me a well-rounded person at this point, and being able to interact with different walks of life and stuff like that. But as far as coercing people to do various things, sometimes you might have to – I could give people like a little nudge or more than that and encourage them that I'm not going to steer them in the wrong direction. And then at the end of the day, they just got to put their trust in me and my team.
Right.
But I learned at a young age – I don't even know if you're going to get to this. You probably already have mentioned it yet. But I learned at a young age that people will also declothe for the camera naturally for me because I make them so comfortable.
Yeah, right.
And that was something that I learned in high school.
Yeah, right.
Not how to do it. It's just that people are comfortable.
Yeah, right.
And that's all about creating this really trusting – sensitive environment where people kind of.
Well, we had another photographer on whose work is very equally remarkable, very different than yours earlier this season, and after he had come on the Mero, he multiple days later sent me a text with a quote, and I don't remember who it's from, but it said as it pertains to this subject, he said that a photographer is a psychiatrist with a camera. and I thought about that, and whether it's true or not, I hear some of that in what you're saying, that there has to be...
I agree with that.
You have to kind of create this space. I mean, there's, whether it's photography or film directing, there's so many stories about how people have acted as the director on that shoot or on that set in order to bring the best out of that person. Like, there's a very famous, it's almost like urban legend now, about Stanley Kubrick on the set of The Shining.
Oh, wow.
And that he was very, very cold and in a lot of ways very cruel to Shelley Duvall, who in the film is playing Wendy Torrance, the wife who is kind of trapped at the Overlook Hotel with her maniacal husband, Jack, played by Jack Nicholson. Mm-hmm. And how he was just really, really awful to her. But how for him, and again, you know, everyone can judge whether they think the end is justified by the means, but he did that in order to get her on camera at a point where she was kind of emotionally and psychologically frayed. And so he wanted to have the most authentic performance possible. And from what I understand, the way he went about doing that was by actually fraying her so that she wasn't having to act that way.
Wow.
She genuinely was that way. And again, like to me, that raises all kinds of fascinating questions about, like, is it worth it? I mean, questions about subjectivity and ethics and all that stuff. But it's fascinating. But not that you do that. But you're talking about something similar, where you're going, how do I create a space in which I can get the best out of this person?
Fortunately, or fortunately for my subjects, It's definitely not a shining situation, but it's that situation of making them comfortable.
Yeah,
I imagine there are some photographers out there who are socially awkward, and it probably comes out in their pictures, and that's probably what makes their pictures possibly amazing.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
sure.
you might get these frightened, sort of afraid looks. Mm-hmm. That's not the style of my work, but you are a psychiatrist with the camera. I like that. I've had people tell me after they work with me, I didn't know I'd be this comfortable with my body. You know, I've never, so I do a lot of nudes.
Yep.
And whether I'm shooting someone who's mostly, and it's mostly female nudes at this point.
Yeah.
So whether they're married or they have a boyfriend or they're single or whatever, let's say they've been in a relationship 15 years and they're like, you know what, I've never been in front of someone else in 15 years, I thought it would be so weird. But I felt like I wasn't naked.
Yeah,
like, I had
right.
no idea I was naked. They were naked for six hours, and they're like, this was a shock. I felt like I was having coffee with you, or, you know, you and I talking right now. So, and that's just about creating a fun, safe environment where they also feel confident. And to me, the confidence comes with, I think, needing to feel sexy inside and feeling that the person that's photographing you is giving you that feeling that everyone, I thought about that everyone, when everyone's naked, we all want to look sexy.
Yeah.
No matter if we, you know, when we look at ourselves, we all want to like what we see. Most of us probably don't like what we see. I'm probably 99% of the world probably doesn't.
Yeah.
And so you've got to make them feel good.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's something that's, I've been shooting nude since I was 15 or 16.
Yeah.
So it's a very natural thing for me. But it's a, when you said the psychiatry part, that's what made me think about that. Because people say how great of an experience it was, and they want to do it again.
Well, and that aspect of your work, I mean, is really, really marvelous. I mean, because there's this just like, you do, I mean, you kind of reference this at the beginning about articulating who someone is, who they really are, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's something about in some of that work of yours that again, you know, I looked through and my wife looked through it, and it's just really remarkable, because with some people you sense this almost like you sense a vulnerability.
Uh-huh.
With some people you sense that real naivete or this sense of innocence. Or first, there's one in particular. Or maybe it's a sequence, I'm not sure, but it's where there's someone coming up out of the water.
Okay, yeah, Ivory.
But it's just like it's so beautiful the way you do it, and I don't know, I'm so taken by that.
Shark migration was happening during that footage,
really?
By the way.
Yeah, where was that done?
That was in Palm Beach at a sunrise.
Wow.
And the model lives down there, and she could see dorsal fins. She was telling me there was shark migration. We kept having to run out of the water. She was a good 40 feet in more than I was, so I felt comfortable. Because
I'm
like, they're going to get her first. but it all turned out well. That's actually one of my favorite shots.
It's
in my sort of abstract fine art world.
It's really beautiful, and so I mean, there's so many, you know, fascinating questions. I mean, how do you, I mean, because I mean, talk about, you know, being in a vulnerable space and needing to create an environment where someone feels, and when I say safe, I guess I think of things like not only emotionally safe, psychologically safe, but physically safe, free of judgment,
mm-hmm.
free of shame.
Mm-hmm.
How do you enter that space and create a place where someone feels like you are going to capture them in a way that doesn't just reduce them to a naked body?
Sure.
You know, that doesn't like trend into, you know, the obscure galaxy of obscenity or you know, whatever, pornography or whatever.
Sure. I generally, when someone's nude on set, I'm generally looking at them. When I look at them, it's generally through my camera.
Okay.
And then when we're engaged and talking,
yeah,
I'm generally focused on their eyes. I mean,
okay.
I pay attention to, I'm not like looking at their body unless yeah. I'm taking their picture.
Okay.
But I also act like they're not even naked, because to me, it is second nature. I've been doing yeah. that for 15, 16. I've been,
yeah.
you know, I was shooting naked people before I was sexually active.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So, to use the appropriate high school yeah. term. So, it really is second nature to me. Mm. And so, I think because of that, it comes off that way. Like, yeah. you could be a, you know, drop dead, beautiful human there, and it's not a sexual thing to me, and then it's definitely yeah. not to them. And this, yeah. I don't think it's something that you can really act. I think you either act that way or you don't. Like, my friends that don't do this are like, Ben, I could never do what you do.
Yeah, right.
Like, I couldn't be around someone mm-hmm. and like just take a pic, you know.
Sure.
And so for me, I'm like, okay, like, you know, I've seen way more nude people mm-hmm. under the camera than I have in a personal environment.
Yeah, right.
So to me, it's more normal
yeah.
to not touch a naked body,
sure,
you
sure,
know,
sure.
when I'm photographing you. Cause
sure.
that, so, yeah, it's I forgot your question.
Well, I mean, I think you answered it. Or at least it certainly comes through in your work. I mean, you create an environment.
Oh, yeah, there's always music.
Where people feel empowered by
yeah.
you, where they trust not only the way you're going to interact with them in the moment,
yeah.
but they trust what you're seeking in the outcome.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And you're not trying to objectify someone.
No.
I mean, you're trying to capture who they are.
So I would say it's much harder to take a photograph of somebody without clothes than with clothes. I mean, with clothes, you can say, all right, you know, unbutton that button and, you know, put your hands in your pockets
yeah.
and give me a walk away and, like, twirl so the jacket has a little bit of, like, air behind it or whatever.
Yeah.
And, like, oh, all of a sudden you've got, like, some motion and a cool shot. And
yeah.
when you're naked, there's nothing to work with
mm-hmm.
besides
yeah.
the person's limbs and
yeah.
expressions and
yeah.
their hair, if they have hair on their head.
Mm.
So it's much more challenging to take a good picture of someone without clothes.
Yeah.
And then generally, I don't think you have seen this series. It's not on my website at the moment. But one of my favorite things to do is to shoot fully naked people without even actually showing, quote unquote, anything. Like,
yeah.
you can be fully naked, but it's kind of what you're saying. It can be sensual and beautiful, but it's probably not sexual in any capacity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, shooting like that and just making a beautiful image where, you know, the body is celebrated, because
yeah.
I've shot lots of different bodies
yeah.
and I can always find beauty in whatever type
yeah.
of body I'm shooting. And
yeah.
so, and make that person in that body feel like they're the sexiest woman alive, you
yeah,
know?
Right.
So, and I'm not faking that. In that moment, that is
yeah.
what I'm feeling and thinking, and it's a natural connection to
yeah.
create that. I mean, this is something I'll probably talk about differently every 10 years. And I've talked about people that I photographed, like, okay, you know, what made this shoot so great? And, the more I talk about other people and, you
yeah.
know, and then they're surprised if they've never been shot naked, like, oh my God, this is crazy. Like, I had no idea.
Right.
I've been naked
right.
just eating pizza with
right.
you all
right.
day. You know, it's
right.
like,
sure.
So
sure.
it's funny. It's
well, and I mean, this in my mind, as you were kind of, you know, reaching the tail end of that, because you mentioned the word
beauty. No pun intended.
Yeah, right. as you were wrapping that up, my mind immediately went, because you mentioned this word, you mentioned the word beauty.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, Ben, like, how do you define beauty? I mean, it's a subjective term, even though at times it feels like culturally we make an objective definition of it, like it's mm-hmm. these dimensions or it's this kind of sunset. But how do you define beauty?
It's a good question, and fortunately, I did take some women's studies classes at Vassar that talked about the heterosexual male gaze and in society and in commercial things. So I feel like I don't know if I have a good answer. I mean, how do I define beauty? If it's a person, I define beauty if it's of a person, if they like it and if they think they look good, then I have no idea how to answer that question.
Yeah, I mean,
my last show was called Vibrant Beauty. I don't know.
Without a definition. Vibrant ambiguity.
Vibrant. It was my nudes in water and abstract seascapes and stuff like that. But how to define beauty? I mean, like I said, I like things that are aesthetically pleasing. So when you were talking about earlier, when people look at art for just a second or whatever,
yeah.
To me, if someone is looking at a picture or in a book, if you look at that image longer than it takes you to either turn the page in the book or hit next or swipe down on your phone, to me, that image did its purpose because you actually looked at it for longer than the absolute minimum.
I don't have an answer either. I mean, I think Einstein would say, you know, whether in science or art, that the most beautiful thing we can encounter is mystery. Yep. And some sort of indefinable thing mm-hmm. in a person or in an image or in a moment. And you know, then I think of, you know, the legend in Greek mythology of Narcissus.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who looks down, sees his reflection in the lake and is so captivated by his own appearance
sure.
that it's then all he want. And my wife and I were in a small secondhand bookstore in Massachusetts where I could live, you know, for the rest of my life. I love places like that. But I was reading about this one individual's kind of analysis of that story that I hadn't thought of, and I do think it's kind of germane to the conversation of beauty. And he said, so much of what's happening in that story, though, is Narcissus is led to believe that the only beautiful thing about him is the part that's most, quote, pleasing or acceptable, his appearance, rather than saying, what does it look like for me to also embrace the fact that what are often considered the, quote, unacceptable parts of me or the displeasing parts of me, you know, whether emotionally or psychologically, emotionally, the mourning end of the spectrum, the sad end of the spectrum, the anger end of the spectrum, the self-conscious end of the spectrum, all those pieces, that those also have beauty too. And so if we only engage that part of the spectrum where we are kind of most generally told is beautiful or where right. the consensus is most often found, we kind of neglect this entire other realm of what is beauty. And so for me, I don't know how to define it other than
I say confidence. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, and in the whole spectrum, though,
yeah.
Not just in this part of my body,
right.
Not just in this era of my life when I weighed this or my hair was like this or my complexion was like this, or not just, I mean, who's is a smile prettier than a tear? You know, is a wedding more beautiful than a funeral? And it's like, in some ways, yes, but in some ways, no. I mean, because to me, I think about a funeral, and I think about how remarkable it is when you see a group of people rallying
yeah.
around a mourning widow, or to see the impact that someone's life had on a whole community. I mean, maybe sometimes, you know, I'm just not trained to see and recognize that kind of beauty, even when it's right beneath my feet.
Spoken like at a cemetery.
Yeah, right.
It's when you asked how do I sort of set the scene or how do I know how to create this environment, I thought of a story that I'm sure has impact on how my career on my career trajectory in this nude environment. Probably my first shoot like that in 10th or 11th grade, I set up a photo studio on the third floor of my house. And we weren't allowed to have doors shut when you had some buddy in the house of opposite sex. Now, okay. Now that I'm saying that, it's a very heterosexual way of parenting. I'm now saying that, saying, okay, when I'm a parent, are you not allowed to have doors shut when anyone's over? Because yeah. Now that I'm saying that, it's yeah. like very, that's quite an assumption for my yeah. parents. I could have been anywhere with a guy, but if there was a girl over, no doors would be allowed to be shut. So kind of, I should ask my parents about this. So anyway, I had a girl on third floor and we were taking pictures and it was my first nude shoot. Mm. And she's probably, you know, she was a girl I had like crush on in high school, I'm sure. Mm. And my dad just walked in, opened the door and just walked in. And she was wearing bottoms but nothing on top. And she immediately covered herself like this mm. with her hands across her chest. And as soon as the door opened. And I was horrified. And my dad mm. talked to us for probably 10 minutes. He stood in the doorway asking how the shoot's going. Probably asked her a couple of questions like, who are you? Or you guys go to high school together?
Yeah.
And I have no idea what we were talking about. But the whole time I was so embarrassed that like, oh my God, my dad won't leave. This is so crazy. Mm. And as soon as he walked out and said, okay, like, have a good shoot and shut the door, she goes, your dad is so cool. I was like, yeah, totally, he is.
Yeah.
She was like, he acted like it was no big deal and, like, didn't even acknowledge that I was, like, covering myself and didn't even, like, look at me. It didn't even – I forgot I was standing there with my hands over my chest. Mm-hmm. Like, your dad's awesome. I'm like, yeah, like, of course my dad was like that.
Yeah.
And I was shocked that – hmm. I didn't know that's how she was feeling. I couldn't get it out of my head in the moment of, I can't believe, you know, my dad sees us, you know, shooting or whatever like this. Hmm. And then afterwards, the shoot, I went to talk to him. And I was like, by the way, thanks for handling that so well.
Hmm.
She thought you were super cool.
Yeah.
And then he was like, I want to show you something. And then he pulled out nudes that he took when he was in college that I didn't even know he ever did. He was like, look, it was a serious hobby of mine. I did this also.
Mm.
If you're going to do this, do it the right way.
Mm.
And, you know, i.e., you know, respect your subjects. And because I think he handled it with the maturity, he assumed that I had the maturity to do this well and treat people the right way, that probably had some effect on how I actually handled myself in these scenarios. I'm like, okay, like, my dad's letting me do this in his house and trusting that I'm gonna take care of these people. And it was actually funny because I don't think my mom didn't know I was shooting nudes in the house until they came parents weekend for freshman year at college. And I had all my nudes as like probably like trophies as an 18-year-old in my dorm room on my wall. My mom was like, when were these taken?
Yeah, they're she's in the front stairwell. Star Wars poster in the background.
Exactly. No Star Wars for me. No, it probably would have been like a Grateful Dead or something. But there's all these nudes taken in our house, living room, stairwell, backyard. Like, when were these taken? I'm like, oh, when you guys were out of town. And she goes, like, Bob, did you know about this? He was like, yeah, I knew he was like, doing this. So it was always unspoken after, like, I mean, prior to that. And I didn't even know my mom didn't know, which is kind of funny. So anyway, it's kind of a fun story.
But what a powerful moment just to have not only your dad in the aftermath sort of mentor you through some of the early stages of what can be a tricky situation,
not only for
you as an artist, but also for your subjects. Not only for that, but also just to affirm some of your artistic inclinations and to kind of empower you to go, yes, like, you're good at this, and here's some of the things I've done. And I mean, you know, one of the most meaningful moments I ever had with my dad, and my dad's been deceased for almost 10 years now.
Sorry.
But my dad, who was an educator for his adult life, you know, he was a high school teacher, then he was a superintendent, he was a college professor. But I never knew him to have kind of leveraged his energy towards more of kind of the traditional categorizations of arts.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew when I was a kid that I really enjoyed writing and that, you know, words were kind of my playground.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was around a freshman in high school. And he took me into the garage. He just said, you know, maybe a little similar. And he said, I want to show you something. And he, you know, my parents were hoarders. So, you know, we're climbing over just all of this, all these artifacts and junk and whatnot. And we finally reached this kind of dust-covered filing cabinet, and with a loud screech, he pulls it open, and he reaches inside into the back, and he removes this little book that he had written called "Let's Go to Ant City," and it was just this like tiny little novella or whatever. It was like, you know, 27 pages illustrated about this colony of ants. And
this is a book that he wrote.
That he had written, and he had written it in college, and he had had one of his peers illustrate it and everything. And I think in some ways it was just so cool to get a glimpse into a dimension of my dad that I just had never been acquainted with.
Mm-hmm.
But I did feel, and I even think about it now, like I think it still empowers me now to see that he had done that and that he had saved it. I mean, just like your dad. Like, it's not like that was a part of his life he wanted to discard and walk away from, even though your dad was a pediatrician,
right,
or even though my dad was an educator.
Yeah.
And the fact that he held on to it, that's like, in some way, it seems indicative of a real sense of pride in that.
Yeah.
Now, I remember my dad doing that for me, and similar. That was just a really, really powerful moment for me, and kind of remains today.
Those are both nice memories.
So we're almost out of time, Ben. But I do want to ask you, so you're always on the other side of the lens, as it were.
Uh-huh.
Do you like having your photograph taken?
I do.
Really?
Probably embarrassing to say. I'm going to put people in two different categories. You either like having your photo taken or you don't. And I'm going to say the people that like having their photo taken probably are photogenic, naturally photogenic, meaning,
because
I believe everyone can be photogenic if they have the right person directing them on how to pose and whatever like that. So when someone says, oh, I don't want to be photographed, I'm not photogenic, I'm like, okay, like, just wait, we'll take a picture and like it'll all be good. And so, or the people that don't like their photo taken probably don't think that they're photogenic. Fortunately, I happen to be photogenic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just take good pictures.
Yeah,
so
I can't stand people like you, Ben.
Yeah, so, no, it's like embarrassing. I'm like going on record saying that, but like, thanks.
I hate you, Ben. Ben Shapiro.
I don't know what it is, but I happen to be relatively photogenic, so I don't mind getting my picture taken. Now, however, this is definitely, could you say we're on a date, basically? I definitely won't mention this, like, on first. By the way, I'm a photogenic.
Yeah.
I actually think as a skill, as a photographer, it's important for me to know how to pose myself in order to help pose people. So if I'm shooting a menswear campaign and I need the guy to, you know, sit there or stand there and hold the paper or whatever, I often will get in the pose myself. I'll sit in a chair, cross my leg, put the paper down, you know, turn the head, you know, a little bit, and you have glasses in the other hand. Since I know how to take a good picture of myself if someone is photographing me, and I know how to, like, get in that pose quickly, whether it's just a slight turn or whatever,
yeah,
I think that makes me better at what I do because I can more easily direct people.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine myself sitting there or standing
right,
there.
Right, right.
I was actually just hired. It's pretty funny. It hasn't come out yet. It came out, I think, in end December, beginning of January. So Kenneth Cole is featuring me on their website and their Instagram or their whatever. So they interviewed me, like a 20-question interview, and they had me come in and say, like, will you style yourself? So I went through their new collection and I picked out some clothes, and they generally have their in-house photographer then shoot said subject in their environment. But they recently had let go of their in-house photographer. They're like, since you're a photographer, would you actually consider shooting yourself for this? And I was like, sure. And we're not talking like a selfie in a mirror.
Yeah, right.
And I decided to do it without any assistants or interns or anyone helping me take it. And one of the shots I did was, I live in the Lower East Side right off Bowery, and I have my camera on a tripod on one side of the street, and I have it on a 10-second timer, and I'm sprinting across the street. I have like an acorn.
And that's a busy street.
It's
too,
a busy street.
In,
it's
in Manhattan.
It's like Rivington and Bowery.
Yeah,
so
that's
yeah,
a busy
yeah.
street in Manhattan. Yeah.
And I'm sprinting across the street to pose like at the acorn or like leaf I had put down to go stand in front of him because I'm only focused
that's
on that small
mark.
On that small plane. And people were coming out from the bar to ask me if I wanted help. Two different people came. They're like, can I help you? I'm like, well, technically I have to do this myself, so like I can't really offer your help. By the end of it, I had a crew, took me probably like an hour, and I looked ridiculous, just sprinting and then like posing and trying not to laugh because people are watching me at this point. I had a crew of like four or five strangers that were like directing traffic, telling cabs when to go
wow.
or not. Because at one point, because Kenneth Cole wanted to look like New York, so I'm like, all right, let's get like a, you know, like a yellow cab and a
sure.
background or something. So it was like random strangers like making a cab whose meter was on with someone in it, telling them to stop. I'm like, okay,
you're
like,
playing crossing
and,
guard.
And the cab stops.
Wow.
It was a pretty fun experience being photographed by myself for that, which was ridiculous, but it ended up coming out well.
Well,
so.
and you are photogenic, so
oh my God.
For people that fall into the other category you identified, of which I am like the chief fan and
by,
czar.
By the,
you know?
By the way, I will tell you what category I don't identify with is a good voice. So
oh.
you have a sexy
oh.
voice, and everyone that's listening to this, I apologize if I sound like a 12-year-old for the last hour.
Well, no.
You've got this low baritone,
yeah.
nice voice, want to listen to.
I practice in front of the mirror, Ben.
I'm
that's
sure
the,
you do.
That's the secret. Well, so. And I mean, your work really is, I mean, it's marvelous. It's Ben Fink Shapiro.com. I mean, please, if you get a moment today, everybody, check it out. If you get even longer moments, I mean, these are the kind of photographs and moments that Ben has captured that really, they really are worthy of more than just a passing second of our time. I mean, your work is marvelous, and if you really want to put to the test to see what kind of magician you are behind the lens, then you can try to see if you could make even me photogenic someday.
Are we talking nudes?
I don't know. I mean, I'm awkward enough when I'm wearing my wearing my Chuck Taylor. So what the heck? maybe that's the secret for me. Is all the clothes are just my problem, right?
Yeah, that might be the problem.
Well, Ben,
as my voice got high.
Ben, thank you so much for coming on the Marrow.
Thanks for having me.
I love your work, and yeah, I hope we get to do it again sometime.
This would be awesome.
Thanks so much for listening to the Marrow. To find me on social media for upcoming live appearances or to buy a book, you can visit joshreebach.com, but please join me again next week.